the field. Okay, great. So quite a few people. And I'm going to touch on some of the themes in which Tony and I talked about, particularly around the story that we tell ourselves about what it means to be human and what the impact is of our civilization at the moment, and the greater cultural collective stories that we're telling, because I think that they fundamentally need to be changed. But also, I'm going to go into a lot more detail about our individual stories and about in my work as a psychologist over the last 40 years, really, because I firmly believe that the stories that we tell ourselves are really at the heart of how we experience the world, and largely account for how happy or sad we are, how fulfilled or unfulfilled we are, as well as determining the quality of our communities and society and the way we treat the planet as a whole. So I'm going to try and link these different things together. For those of you who don't know me, I have quite an unusual background. I started life as an academic, but then took a detour, worked in the IT industry, ran and set up an IT company, which I then sold, went back to university to finish my DPhil, but ended up teaching instead. And I've worked in the environmental sector for about 21 years, mainly teaching organizational behavior and leadership within green MBAs and within environmental management courses. I also set up and ran about three or four environmental businesses. So I've seen this issue from many different stories. But the one theme throughout my career has been my love and interest in psychology, and particularly beliefs, which is what I did at my master's level, was really understanding how we create our beliefs and our stories and our worldview, because I think that's the absolute lever for change. So to illustrate what I mean by a story, I'd like to talk about a story that you might have heard before, but it really illustrates it. There was once a consultant who went to investigate workers and find out why they were happy, why they were engaged or disengaged. And he came across three bricklayers, and he asked them what they were doing. And the first one replied, "I'm laying bricks." The second one replied, "I'm putting up a wall." And the third one responded, "I'm building a cathedral." And this is the point, that it's not so much what happens to us in life, but it's the interpretation we have on what happens. All of us are going to have our ups and downs. All of us are going to have a wide range of circumstances and experiences, but some of us are a lot better at making sense of them and interpreting them. And I call these our stories. So these bricklayers had three different stories. And as we went into this extraordinary time during the pandemic, we heard a whole number of stories about what was happening. Some individuals were traumatized by it, and quite rightly, because it was terrifying for many people at first. Some people triumphed and changed their life. But a lot of people, I think, regarded this period during the pandemic as a chance to really reflect on what matters most in their lives and sit back and think about their stories and think about their future. And I also believe that during this extraordinary period of time out we've been living through, that it's really we've seen the seeds of what could be a new story for humanity. The way we were carrying on up to January or February in 2020 was on a one way path to complete catastrophe. You know, those of you who know about climate breakdown and ecological collapse, and I assume everyone on this call is very familiar with this, know that we simply couldn't carry on the way we were. We've had a story about what it means to be human, which has been toxic and dysfunctional. It's been about rampant, what we call predatory capitalism. Many of the themes of your better nature, you know, that we're disconnected from nature, that nature is a resource for us to exploit, but we're consumers and we're here to consume as much as possible, and that our happiness is based on how much we can consume. This is a story which was initially born in the United States and the UK and Western Europe. But then it expanded into the Asian economies, into emerging economies, and it's become the dominant mythology of our age. This, whatever your political persuasion, I think we can say that consumerism and capitalism is the dominant methodology and ideology. And it's causing a huge amount of problems. But I want to start, first of all, really, by talking about our individual stories. And the big idea of my work and my last two books, really, is that it's your story that's making you happy or sad. It's your story that's making you focused or restless. It's your story that's making you motivated or disengaged. It's not your circumstances. It's not your job. It's not your relationships. It's not where you live or what you earn. Yes, they have an impact, but I can point out for every person who is unhappy at the level of circumstances you have, there's somebody else who's very happy. It's all about our interpretation. And the problem is we are conditioned through our upbringing and by our culture to almost make ourselves unhappy because we've bought into this collective idea that we have to keep on acquiring more and more stuff to be happy. And as soon as we get what we think we want, we ran on to the next thing. This is, in psychologists call this the hedonic treadmill, the idea that we're on a treadmill of constantly trying to make ourselves happy and get that dopamine fix. But you can never do it, even if you're a billionaire. You know, you just have to look at the fact of what's happening with certain leaders of the USA at the moment. They're not happy people. Most billionaires are no happier than other people, but they bought into this idea that is so destructive. We have many stories. We have a story about politics. We have a story about the environment. We have a story about our neighbours, our friends, about many different areas. But the most important story that I focus on in my work is what I call your life story. And there's a quotation by Mark Twain that I find very powerful. The two most important days in your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why. And in my work as a psychologist, I truly believe that our mission in life is to find out why. Now, I'm not suggesting there's a religious or a spiritual why, but, you know, we need to find it through that channel. But what I do believe is those people who find out their why, their meaning and their purpose for living are far happier, far more fulfilled, and I think generally healthier. There's a lot of research in the field of positive psychology, which is my speciality, which really shows that if you can find a story, what I call a significant story, that can bring together the different elements of your life and say where you've come from, where you are, and most importantly, where you're going, you will be happier. And the problem is that so many of our stories aren't our own. We buy into stories. It could be our parents' story. They influenced us in our education, in our choice of career. It could be our friends' story. Peer pressure pushed us down a certain way. It could be our culture's story that we bought in to all the marketing, all the advertising, all the hype. But part of our job, and I think now is such a good time during this strange purgatory we're all in at the moment, is to really discover your own story and distinguish it from anybody else's. Because your story is so critical because it's really the lens through which you experience your life, through which you decide what is good or bad, what's right or wrong. But so often this works at an unconscious level. But the tale you tell yourself, the story you tell yourself, is a narrative arc. And there's a field of psychology called narrative therapy that was developed in the 70s and 80s that's, I think, very effective, because what it helps clients do is really see the narrative arc of their life that sequences important events, insights and breakthroughs. We are meaning-making creatures, and it's very important to understand how this fits together so we can organise our memories and experiences into a meaningful framework. What I found working with thousands of people, mainly in business, from graduates all the way up to CEOs, is that stories can make or break you. Only you know if the story you're telling yourself about your upbringing, about your experience, about your relationships, about your career is really serving you or not. But I do know for thousands, millions of people, the stories we tell ourselves really hold us back and they limit us. They can turn us into victims. They can make us very passive and it can lead to indecision, restlessness and insecurity. Because as the novelist Anna Nin said, we don't see things as they are, we see them as we are. We see reality through the filter of our stories. I'll give you an example, and this is based on clients I work with. I call negative stories or limiting stories, I call them insignificant stories. Let's say you have two identical twins who are born and have a very tough upbringing. They both struggle in their childhood with loss and extreme anxiety and trauma, even. So the first twin becomes resentful and angry. They become a victim. They want, and the way they respond is really looking out for number one, doing whatever they can to be successful at any cost, to make up and compensate for their childhood and make themselves feel better. They become survivors. That's their mentality. They're fighting. They're competitive. They're ambitious. They are compensating for their terrible childhood. Whereas the other twin had exactly the same experience of loss, anxiety, and trauma. But they handle setbacks and challenges very differently. They were naturally more resilient or learned to be resilient, and they became stronger in response to their experiences. They became a strong, resilient person, and their upbringing gave them the resources to be more self-confident, and their troubles gave them more empathy and compassion for others because they'd experienced so much difficulties, and they became a thriver rather than a survivor. The same events, but two totally different stories. And you can see this with siblings, that some siblings will react to their childhood and exactly the same parenting in very different ways. But again, it's not what happens to you, it's how you interpret it and how you respond to it. And there are a huge amount of benefits of choosing a more positive, what I call a significant story. When you have a significant story, you can focus more on what on the future rather than what's happened to you in the past. You can be who you want to be rather than how circumstances molded you. It can help you find your purpose, your calling, be more motivated and determined. It can really help you have more direction and find more fulfillment and become what I call a more coherent person, where you're more harmonious and balanced and things fit together better. Can be more authentic and really, I think, be in a much better position to make a positive contribution to society. And as Joseph Campbell, who, if you haven't come across, please read about him. He developed this idea of the hero's journey. And so many of our lives, I think, can be constructed and seen as a hero's journey. Doesn't mean we have to go and save a planet or do great things, but just dealing with the struggle of being born and making it through childhood, adolescence, and the early years, it is heroic in many ways to come through that and to triumph. But what Joseph Campbell said was, we must be willing to let go of the life we planned so as to have the life that's waiting for us. So many of the things we wanted when we were younger proved to be fruitless, proved to be unfulfilling. And now, when we write our new story, we can really go to that next level. So, the thing is, if we all see the world differently, and it's very difficult to say what's true, especially when understanding people and events, there are a thousand different perceptions. Isn't it better to choose a story that really serves you and that really helps you? And I think there's certain qualities of a significant story, a significant life story that will really help you. And if you've followed me so far, I'd like to suggest about eight qualities that I think can make a huge difference when you write your new story. First of all, be authentic. It's got to be your story, not somebody else's. It's got to come from you. And you have to work through a lot of limitations, often work through shame and vulnerability. And to be honest, can be very, very hard. And a lot of people do need therapy in this process or a coach to help them. But be honest with yourself. Secondly, it should be positive. And I don't mean, oh, everybody's happy and being Pollyanna-ish, but positive in terms of life will be better when you go down this direction because you're escaping some of the traps of the past. Thirdly, and really importantly, it needs to be meaningful. What I found, and what studies in positive psychology have found, and what Viktor Frankl found in Man's Search for Meaning, which is still one of the two or three greatest books I've ever read, is that those people who find meaning and purpose in their lives can get through anything. Viktor Frankl developed was an Austrian Jewish psychologist who was sent to Auschwitz and saw most of his family killed. And the reason he survived, and when so many didn't, was he had a meaning and purpose. He had a story that helped him get through this. And he developed a field of psychology called logotherapy, which is very similar to humanistic psychology and existential psychology. But the idea is when we connect to something bigger than ourselves, we access a deep source of well-being and strength. And he was able to do that in the most terrible circumstances. One of my clients, I've just helped write a book and did a research for it on resilience. And Emma studied and interviewed 50 of the world's most resilient people. These were people who'd lost their family in terrorist attacks, who had lost children to the most awful accidents, who'd lost all their limbs and had the most terrible life-threatening illnesses. And what she found was certain things in common. And one of the central things was they all found meaning. And they were generally happier than most of us. And it wasn't false, it wasn't fixed, it was genuine and authentic. The next quality of a significant story is that it's autonomous. Now, what I mean by that is if your story in life is dependent on something happening outside of you, then you need to be very cautious. If your story can only be meaningful if you, I don't know, win the lottery or become CEO or become a millionaire or win an Oscar, I don't know, something that happens outside, or find that perfect person who doesn't really exist, but we might believe they are. If you have a story that's dependent on things outside of yourselves, it's very unlikely that it's a good quality story. The best stories are based on our intrinsic needs, are based on our inner life. And once you get that inner life right, you're far more likely then to have a happier external life, outer life, in your relationships, your work, your career. So the big idea behind my work in significance is that it's inside out, not outside in. But we're in a world and in a culture where it's all outside in. Oh, if only I had this house, if only I had that job, if only I had this relationship, then I'd be happy, then I'd be fulfilled. And it's nonsense. And we've built this consumerist culture that is all predicated on this, and it's just not true. Next, it needs to be practical, achievable. You know, if your story is about becoming the next pope or, you know, changing every aspect of the world, well, that's great. But it's much better to have a story which is about influencing your community, doing work that Carrie's doing or a lot of us on this call are doing. It should be coherent, and it should unite both your inner life and your outer life. You shouldn't be one person at home, another person at work, another person when you're volunteering. The best stories are coherent across everything you're doing. Should support your personal growth. And in my view, it should be noble. For me, it means working an environmental cause. You know, have a cause which is contributing to the world, and that will bring out a greater energy in you again. So there's a number of exercises to do this, but one of the simplest ones I suggest to you, which we can all do, is when you're feeling restless or when you're facing a problem or a challenge or a predicament, ask these three questions. Do I need to change the other person, or do I need to change my story? Do I need to change my circumstances, my work, where I live, what I do, or do I need to change my story? And do I need to change my behavior, or do I need to change my story? Because if you put more of your focus on changing yourself and your story, you're then having more control over your life, and that will make you far more effective, far more successful in whatever you do, but above all, more happy and fulfilled. Because when you change your story, you change your life. So that's a bit about individual stories, but I want to finish by chunking up, if you like, to our collective stories, because the fact is, our dominant cultural story is dysfunctional and toxic. It's about at best taking for granted and at worst exploiting our majestic planet. It's led to the destruction of our ecosystems, and it's threatening our very survival as a species. This collective story that we of endless growth, of exploiting nature, of putting our own individual needs and lifestyle choices above anything else, but it's okay, we're entitled to do what we want. Well, it might work with a billion people in the world, it cannot work with 8 billion and the increasing population that we have. Our current story of rampant growth, climate breakdown, ecological collapse, is a disaster, and we need to write a new story. We need a story that's good for us, good for our community, good for humanity, and good for the planet. We are caring and compassionate. We're not just self-interested, rational, economic actors. We're citizens, not just consumers. There's a lovely quote from Chico Mendes, who was an environmentalist in Latin America. At first, I thought I was fighting to save rubber trees. Then I thought I was fighting to save the Amazon rainforest. Now I realize I am fighting for humanity. And like that bricklayer example I started with, if we can find a story that's noble and uplifting and is about contributing and doing something important to really trying to prevent this environmental nightmare that we are going through, it will be so much good, better for you and for those people around us. And one of the exercises I do with clients, and you consider doing for yourself, is to answer these four questions. What do you stand for? Who do you want to be? And answer this: I want a world where, and I commit to. And if you can really be clear about those things and then find your place in your campaign, find something that really touches you and you're passionate about. It could be recycling. It could be the Repair Cafe. It could be joining XR. It could be joining the Green Party, Friends of the Earth. It doesn't really matter, but it's finding something that really answers those four questions. Then you can start to write your own significant story. And significance means living your story faithfully in everything you say and do. Because when you act coherently and consistently, you will change. You will feel better. You will feel happier. You will find new energy. And other people will notice. Other people will see that you are revitalized. Because your story is how you live your life. So many of us live our life based on our moods, based on our energy levels, based on what we want from other people, based on our needs for approval, control, security. But when you live your life through your story, like somebody who's very religious, you acquire this incredible zeal, this incredible vitality, which everybody else can see. And this makes a massive difference to our mind, our body, and our spirit. And there's a lot of evidence, again, from the fields of neuroscience and positive psychology, that the key to happiness is really living this way. It just upgrades everything. And right now, the world needs us to have a new story. We have to change what it means to be human. And I leave you with one of my favorite quotes from the late poet Mary Oliver, who's a wonderful American poet. And it's very simple. What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Because life is precious. And once you accept how precious it is, and once you really acknowledge, you won't waste more time with an old story that has held you back. You will look to the future, you will develop a story that's right for you, and you will improve every aspect of your life. And the closing words for my last book were this: if you loved yourself unconditionally, you would choose your time wisely and use your time wisely. You would choose to refocus on what matters most. You would choose to be the best version of you every day. You would ensure that your one wild and precious life was significant. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. That was amazing. In such a short period of time, so many wise words, so many nuggets, and so many actions and things to embrace. Now, would people like, I think we're a number where we could actually just pop up our hand if you'd like to ask something. Keir, do you want to?
No, I thought it was the sort of applause. Sorry.
Oh, right. Applause for Vine. So I have questions, but has anybody, if you'd like to actually ask a question, raise a point, share something, if you just maybe pop your hand up, turn your camera on and put your hand up. I can't see everybody. Has anyone got their hand up? Yeah. Oh, so Keith and Leanne. Hello.
Hi. hi, Carrie. Thank you. And thank you very much, Paul. It's great to hear that. My question is, at what point did you change your story in your life?
Well, I've talked about this on Your Better Nature, so some of you will know this already. There's been a series of events that have happened in my life, both in my personal life and professional life. But the real change was when I read a book. And the book was Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight by Tom Hartman, who then became a friend. Up until 1999, I was very successful in business. I had a large business with nearly 500 employees that I started. I lived that jet set life, but I was living through my ego. I had no real soul. Yes, I looked after my family. Yes, I was a basically decent human being, but it was all about success and everything. But I read this book, and it changed everything. I literally didn't work in my business ever again after that. And the book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, really laid out the facts of how we're destroying the planet and how our business-based corporate civilization is toxic and destructive. And I was on my way to a computer conference in Los Angeles. I canceled my flight and I went up and spent a week with the author because he'd been introduced by a friend. And I changed everything after that. But it's not something, you know, it's to an extent a road to Damascus experience, which is suitable for someone called Paul. But it took a long time to still sort of deconstruct and change my older life. It's a work in progress. But I then had a direction. I had a path and a lot of mistakes I made along the way. But now I'm 100% that way. And I don't even recognize myself from my 30s.
Paul, I think Morag's saying here, can you repeat, I know we've recorded this, I started to try and write it down, the four questions that we must ask ourselves. Could you repeat that for us, please?
I can. I think I'm just remembering from memory. It's what do I stand for? What is most important to me? What's the change I want to see in the world? What am I prepared to do to make it happen? I mean, that's in essence those four questions.
Fantastic.
What do I commit to, basically? Yeah. And the idea there is if you can answer those questions, it will really help you get direction in your life, because so much of how we live is responding to things, you know, in our family, our friends, our moods, work, community, things are happening day by day. We tend to be very reactive. But when we have that firm sense of direction, it allows us to, like a GPS system, keep us much more on track and also makes us far more resilient. This is what I found in my research in resilience, is that whatever life throws at you, if you've got clarity about what matters most to you, you can resolve any issue and you can be very tough through any problem.
Is there anyone else? I know I've written down some things here, but is there anyone else that's got any questions for Paul? Keir?
Yeah, Paul, sorry, could you just repeat the title and the author of the book that changed your life?
In fact, Viv is holding it up. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight by Tom Hartman.
The Last
Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which is fossil fuels, basically.
Of course, yeah. Thank you. I'm sorry, it's only a point of information. Thank you very much.
No, my pleasure. And by the way, if any of you have any questions about anything I've said, do email me at paul@paulhannam.com, because I've covered a lot, and I know not everybody likes to ask questions on a Zoom meeting, but any books, any quotes, anything at all, please just send it to me. I'd be delighted to help.
Maybe we could actually include, I know at the end of each of the Your Better Nature sessions, you know, you've actually provided really brilliant links and books, resources, and obviously the videos are there. So are those all on one web page? I know they've been coming through on the emails. Is that something we can point people towards, a page that summarises all of those things?
I think we can, Viv. Do we have a page? Did you unmute yourself?
There you go. Hi, everybody. Hi. Some of you know us already. This is the Your Better Nature webinars. At the moment, they're on the YouTube channel, but each webinar has got its own separate section. We will be collating, shall we say, all the information across the five webinars as well. So that will probably be available only to the people who've booked in tickets. So we'll have to think about that one. I'll take it to our team and we'll have a chat about that and see what we can do.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, if there is a page, we could add to the blog that Keir's going to write the links to the videos, which have got the resources, I think, underneath them. But anyway, let us know and then we can include it in the blog and share it with everybody. Paul, before everyone arrived, I asked you, I'd noted Groundhog Day from one of your Better Nature events, and the fact that you'd said, you know, it was really, really a very moving film, very poignant at the moment. Can you, or who was it that's also a groundhog? Could someone tell everyone once again, you know, why Groundhog Day is a good one to watch?
Well, for me, Groundhog Day, not just the movie, but the idea of being stuck in a repetitive loop really sums up the human condition. I first saw the film 27 years ago and loved it. Then I was fortunate enough to become friends with the screenwriter, and I wrote two books, quite different, but the last book 4 years ago. And I used it in my work, both at university and in my coaching and in my leadership development work, because for me, the core idea of the movie is that, as those of you who don't know the movie, he's basically trapped in time, Bill Murray's character, Phil Connors, and he's trapped for, well, the original screenplay is trapped for 10,000 years in the same repeating day. But Hollywood, of course, that was too much, so it's probably about 30 years. But the idea is that he turns the very same day when nothing changes outside of him from the worst day of his life into the best day of his life. And this, for me, struck me as such a profound idea because it sums up not just the human condition of feeling stuck. And I don't mean just stuck in terms of our routine and our daily repetitive lives, which can often be, you know, been a bit different in the last 9 months, but largely repetitive before. But far more importantly for me is how we psychologically, we get trapped in our inner life. I've worked with patients in their 70s and 80s who are reliving the same trauma from when they were, teenagers or younger. And literally, coming back to this idea of stories, they've been retelling themselves the same story day after day. We now know that most of our thoughts are repetitive. Most of our feelings, most of our habits, our behaviours, our instincts, we're replaying them again and again. And unless we change those deeper patterns, we won't change our behaviour. It'll be very, very hard. So the movie is a very amusing and brilliant metaphor, parable, for not just how we get stuck, but more importantly, how we can change and turn the worst day of our lives into the best day of our lives by changing our story. So it comes back to what I said, full circle.
Going to watch it tonight. That's my evening's entertainment. I think Jerry, Jane's other half, do you want to ask your question? Do you want it or do you want me to? You're going to do it?
I can do. I can ask the question, Paul. I was just asking. I was just wondering, hi, Paul, have you got any advice on how, once you've actually made a decision about you want to change your story and you've come up with a plan and everything, I guess one of the hardest things is then maintaining that and actually committing to it and then following that path. And how do you keep yourself on that path? And how do you actually encourage yourself, as it were, to keep going down that route? I mean, I guess you reappraise it again and again and again, but staying committed.
That's a great question. And it's interesting, when we look at personal change or organisational change, this is always the part that's missed out. You know, we're all into these big, exciting events saying, this is the change we want. Everybody gets excited. You've probably all been on these workshops. You get all the flip charts out and you write out all the vision statements, the mission statements. Everybody's gung-ho. We're going to change the world. And then 3 months later, like gravity, we're back to default. And that is the human nature and its organizational nature is we tend to find it very hard to change. So this whole process of change is called maintenance and reinforcement of change. And what I found works best for me, Jerry, and the people I work with, is first of all, to have daily practices or rituals that really reinforces change. For some people, that might be quotes, or I use Google Calendar. I have lots of reminders, lots of mantras, lots of quotes, so that when I wake up in the morning, rather than put the news on and find out the latest drama from the White House or number 10, I will watch a YouTube video which reminds me of the significant story, not all the insignificant stuff that's happening. I have reminders. I practice mindfulness when I really let go and try and connect with what in my books I call my authentic self, or that part of me, that significant story within me, the story I'm trying to develop, and try and let go of all the superficial, all the conditioned self with which we can get so trapped in. But the number one skill, I believe, and key is to be present. Every moment of the day. And what I do in my clients is I say, always ask this question: is what I am doing now significant or insignificant? And by significant, it doesn't mean, you know, going out and saving the planet or doing, you know, big things all the time, but just in the way we listen to people, in the way we talk to ourselves, in our level of awareness. But moment to moment, if we can be present, then that new story will have time to settle, and through habituation will become you. You will become that new story. But if it just stays at the level of a wish or an intention or just a weekend retreat, then it won't happen. It's like anything in life, it's practice. And that's what we miss out in the whole change process, but it's constant practice. But find something that works for you and a ritual. And I'm, you know, there's a lot more I could say on this, but it's a very good question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Maggie, do you want to? You've got a question here. Do you want to ask your question yourself?
Yes, can we go? Yeah. I was quite interested in how Paul, what Paul thinks of the these weird conspiracy theories that are gaining ground on the internet, like QAnon. It's a whole sort of package. That really people seem to take on board and get incredibly angry and engaged in. And isn't that strange? And I just wonder what you thought about it.
Well, it's strange at one level, and I'm very familiar with this because I lived in California up to 2012 and was a member of the Democrat Party there. So I follow politics in the States probably more than England at the moment for obvious reasons. So very familiar with this. For those of you who don't know it, a QAnon conspiracy is there's a number of them, but one of them that Trump is there to save the world from paedophiles. There's all sorts of other conspiracies which are so bizarre, but are now going into the mainstream through Twitter, through Facebook, and it's a huge issue because all the far right groups are coalescing around this insanity. And there'll be all conspiracies about Trump having coronavirus. The USA is a very different culture to ours. There's still, the majority of people don't have passports. There's still states where Darwin and evolution isn't taught, where people, millions of people, believe the world did start 10,000 years ago. They believe it, you know, and it's very strange. But leaving that aside for a moment, there's something more fundamental going on here. And again, this isn't meant to be a dig at religion or anything else, but it's not. Actually, I'm quite a spiritual person in many ways, but the fact is the reason people join religions, the reason people are attracted to very strong ideologies, and this is an extreme version, is because when you join a religion, it's like you have the story given to you. It's like buying an off-the-shelf story. It explains, it's a cosmology. Why you're here, where you're going, what's your purpose, even what's going to happen to you after you die. And that's very attractive to us because we all want some level of certainty. We all want stability. We all want a story. And I think the better religions, you know, really provide a very compelling story. For me, I've always been attracted to Buddhism. I've been attracted to Quakers. And I've been attracted to religions which are less formal and less ritualistic. I was raised as a Catholic, by the way, and used to go to Mass in Latin, so there's a bit of reaction against that. But religions and then more extreme cults or conspiracy theories like this. It's like it's satisfying people's need for connection. It's satisfying their need for meaning, for purpose, gives them a structure. And if you have certain issues or challenges in life, you can be very easily drawn into these. And it's like going to a Trump rally. I've read about these Trump rallies. To me, they're absolutely the worst thing imaginable. But people literally go into an altered state. It's like being in a football ground. If you've ever been to a big sporting event or a great concert, you're uplifted and almost doesn't matter what it means. It's the feeling that these people get. So, again, it's very important we step back and think, why are we doing this? And how else, what's a more healthy way of getting these feelings than buying into these cults and conspiracies? You're on mute, Carrie.
I thought I'd removed it. Sorry. Trying to stop the noise in the background. And whether I can actually, at this point, other people might well have other questions, but at this point, talking about cults and religions and reaching groups of people, I wonder whether I could just share our plan for our outreach initiative for 2020-2021. Is that all right? And we can come back, and if anyone, you know, I appreciate if anyone wants to go, you can go, but I would be interested to hear Paul's ideas on our sort of initiative also. So we're going to be asking Paul about the psychology behind this. So can you see my screen?
Yes.
You can. So... So last year, our Zanny idea was a climate cafe. Thank goodness we set up a climate cafe, because after four physical events, we went online. And that is obviously how we have been connecting with people this year, which has been brilliant. We want to next year actually get out to the villages, get out to the parishes, get out and work in the schools, get out and work in the churches with their communities, and take out a sustainable roadshow to these communities to use the arts, to use drama, to use song, to use dance, to use theatre, interactive activities to help to convey our climate, the climate crisis, but actually inspiring solutions. So we've got various partners, the horse box Clive, who's based in The Haven here, and he's converted a horse box, which has got a DT workshop in the back of it. It's the ramp comes down, bottom, second from left image is the back of the horse box. It comes down to form a woodland theatre. Catherine, who runs our Youth Eco Forum, which meets once a week, 11 plus young people. She's training to be a professional dancer, so she does environmental dancing. We've got a guy who's Keith, Moving Sounds, who's brilliant at environmental music and engaging cross generations with music, environmental music. And very, very Zanny, but at the moment we're actually looking at buying a milk float and then converting it into this green up, power down milk float, and it will go out as a sustainable festival roadshow. So we want to work with parishes, and I've already spoken to about three parish councils, so locations. We're hoping to soft launch this at Wakehurst and the Millennium Seed Bank. They're having a Climate Coalition Show the Love event in February half term. And then we're hoping to formally launch it in Pulborough at Tony and Viv's neighbour's place in Pulborough. So we want to spread the word. And if there's people here that feel they might be able to help in some way, Sussex Green Living and our partners would be delighted to speak to you. There was a lot of work to be done yet. It's how we engage everyday people in this, the climate crisis. So we will be running a fundraising campaign. This isn't exactly how it will look, but these are some visuals that we're going to be presenting to sponsors and applying for some grants. So I just thought I'd share that with you. And yeah, if there's anyone in the audience that would like to get involved, Nicola Peel and myself, Keith from Moving Sounds, Catherine, our Youth Eco Forum leader, and Clive with the School Woodland Theatre Project Lorry Horsebox, which is painted with the evolution of planet Earth, by the way, I didn't say. We're working together on this. So if there's anyone out there that would like to help us, could help us, has got any ideas, and yeah, the psychology behind the messages is going to be absolutely crucial. So Paul, I think we might be seeing if we can call a meeting with you about it.
Well, Paul, just before you answer, Carrie, and I mean, Carrie does a tremendous job at a number of levels, but I'm particularly pleased with this latest initiative.
One of our trustees.
Yeah, okay. Taking it out into the district, because, you know, having listened to what you say, and brilliant, it's all brilliant, it resonates very strongly with my story. It's how are this is a if you like, what we are attempting to do is raise the bar and get more people to pick up on these issues at a serious level rather than just paying lip service to it. And this is obviously what probably everybody on the screen here today, in their own way, is trying to do. But this, to me, is the nub of making, if you like, this sea change in people's attitude. So at a much broader level, we are taking the climate change and the destruction of the planet seriously, and in a concerted way doing it. How can you sort of guide us in ways we might be able to achieve that?
Well, first of all, I think it's a brilliant idea. I think from a psychological perspective, the first question is, who is your audience? Because I posted something on Facebook this morning about students. Each age group, each demographic, you need to have a different appeal. What I just said, I think this can appeal to all groups, but I think particularly to younger people, because it's fun. It's something very specific. So much in the environment, especially when we talk about climate breakdown, is very abstract. And what I love about the idea of the milk float and the other activities that you're doing is it's real. It's something going out into the community, which is fun, which is engaging, which is tangible and specific and very visible. So I think that's extremely important. But linking into my talk, the question I would ask across all these activities is, what is the story you want to tell? What is the fundamental story, the big idea you want to get across? One of the problems, I think, or challenges in the environment is there's so many messages and people can get lost. People can feel overwhelmed. They can feel confused. They can feel unfocused. So what is the one big idea, the central message or story that you want to get across, and really, really focus on getting that right? I think it's important. Get everybody, if you like, singing from the same hymn sheet, even though they're doing different activities.
I think a lot of when we go out, we are hoping to actually work in the parishes with the primary schools and get the primary schools ahead of time actually planning a performance, which will be central to that event that day. So I think our audience is going to be, through the parish council, is going to be the families with children and young people of varying ages, because that's where we feel there are, you know, there are so many children that are so passionate. They do understand that, you know, the way the planet's being treated is wrong. They find it quite hard to communicate the things that they're learning environmentally at school. But I think it's so powerful to listen to a child singing about the environment and the future that they want, the story that they want.
So
I think that at the moment is our, you know, although we've said we could take this pop-up sustainable roadshow out to churches, big churches, it could be an event in itself, or it might form part of an existing event. But if it's a pop-up event, we would want to be working with the parish council and the primary school. So, yeah, there's a lot of work to do on it. I thought I'd just share it with you because we want ideas, we want input, and we're on a journey. We need hope too, don't we, guys? We've had a pants year and we've remained strong and we've kept going with this great network of people and with our weekly meetings, and we've, you know, formed a much bigger network. But we very often it's the similar people that come to these meetings now. We get odd, you know, new people, but we know we need to get out to the non-greenies, if you like. And so this is our idea, our fun idea of actually, you know, through the arts, which everyone's missing, all the arts at the moment, getting out there. So don't need to go on. I mean, if people have got ideas, please share them with me. But I didn't want to take over your show, Paul.
No, not at all. I know Barbara has a question, but just one thought while it's in my mind. What the research shows in terms of trying to influence younger people in particular is getting them actually physically engaged. I know that's harder at the moment, but doing activities so they're sort of physically involved, that makes a big difference. Focusing on short-term wins, short-term goals. Children, well, we all find it difficult to think about the long-term, and part of the problem with dealing with the climate is it's such a long gap between, you know, and the lag effect and really understanding how climate breakdown works. But having short-term goals which are visible, which are measurable, really helps. And using stories, you know, not just stories in terms of what I'm talking about, but stories in terms of tales. You know, I talked about Groundhog Day because often we'll react more emotionally to a film or a great novel or a piece of music than we will to facts and figures. So, but it sounds really good. I think it's great.
Yeah. Sorry, Bart. But was it Barbara? Barbara, yes. Did you want to ask a question? Carry on, please. Thank you, Paul.
In response to what you were saying, Kerry, have you thought about, if they do come back again, sort of village days and so on? That might be quite a good...
Yeah, definitely. Yes, hence we're literally just bounced the proposal back via Paul and our other trustee. We got to strap some finances to it, which I'll look at on Monday with Ian, who is really sort of our financial trustee. But then I want to reach out to the parish councils, and that's the thing. You know, in an ideal world, we form part of an annual event. For example, I've been talking to a parish councillor in Lindfield, and they have a community day in the spring, in about May, I think it is. And when they said they could see the milk float would be brilliant, you know, focusing on green up, power down, with, you know, part of their event. But in September, they always have an arts event, music and, you know, and dance and so on. So they could see actually the whole roadshow forming a really good and a really important part of that. And it fits really nicely in with their climate change sort of strategy and plans for the parish.
Because in Haywards Heath, we have a town day. We have two. We have one we have a spring festival, which is usually in April. Which is on Muster Green, and they have all different charities and community groups that get involved with that. We also have the one in September, which is in Victoria Park, which again is all the community groups coming together and so on. So that might be a good place to go. Also, to link in with perhaps the In Bloom groups.
Yeah.
On the environmental theme, and then you could show
good
how,
idea.
In, you know, environmental things. But I agree with Paul. You've got to show something that can be achieved easily, so that people can then get enthused about things. And I'm just thinking in terms of sort of small nature projects within people's own communities. They've got, for example, the People's Trust for Endangered Species have the Hedgehog Street, which is getting communities together to make their gardens more hedgehog friendly. And so you can have that sort of building a story around that and a narrative around that. But something that's some positive outcomes to make people feel that something can be done and achieved, rather than all the glum stories that we have.
Obviously, the massive advantage of going once in the spring and once in the autumn is you actually are able to return and continue the conversation from earlier in the year and almost measure maybe outcomes and changes that have taken place. And yeah, talking to you, I think actually working with the parish councils who want to actually move towards zero carbon emissions, you know, reduce the carbon emissions, maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe we could, with the parish councils or the councils, town councils, you know, again, some sort of measure can be put in place. Because I think a lot of the grants, you know, they want to see the outcomes, you know, what's measurable, what has been achieved. So our partner, the School Woodland Theatre, Clive, is very, very keen to actually build woodland theatres with the community, which in Pulborough, where we're planning to really properly launch this, he has built a woodland theatre for the primary school in Pulborough. And so we're in liaison with primary school at the moment for them to actually, you know, produce a plan, a performance. But that's a lasting legacy, you know, so that offer outside of the Sustainable Roadshow, that is an offer by Clive, the School Woodland Theatre guy, to go in there and work with whoever wants to in the community to make these woodland theatres. So again, you know, that would be nice, yeah, for the parishes. But yeah, love the Hedgehog Street, and it will involve all sorts of interactive activities. And
can I just say that I think Keith and Leanne has a question for Paul.
Please do ask.
Yes. So I can see this on the chat, and Keith and Leanne have asked, our family is in a very privileged position where we've been able to change our lifestyle and jobs, but many are less lucky or live hand to mouth. We recognise the importance of gratitude in our lives, but wonder if you can make any suggestions to help people who may not have the resources to change the lifestyle cycles that they're trapped in. Well, this is a very complex question. And let me preface with what I'm about to say. As you'll know, for those of you who've watched Your Better Nature, Tony and I have constantly talked about the need for social justice, that tackling this problem, you know, of climate breakdown, ecological collapse, is also a social, political and economic question. And I'm greatly believe that along with climate breakdown, the greatest problem facing the world is inequality. And that inequality is getting worse all the time. So I think there have to be profound structural wealth distribution. So I want to just preface that, where my views are. But in terms of working with individuals, this is where it gets really interesting. If there's nothing worse than being poor in a wealthy country, because it's about your comparison. Psychologically, the reason people get depressed and anxious, yes, of course, below a certain poverty line, when you're, you know, just struggling to pay the heating bills, or for food, or you're, you know, almost homeless, then absolutely you need the basics. But once you have the basics, it's very interesting what the research shows us. And what it suggests is that the story you tell yourself, your attitudes, your beliefs have far more impact. But the problem is, if you are in the lowest 10, 20% in the UK, and even worse in the US, you're in a culture where you're almost meant to feel guilty or morally bankrupt because you're poor. It's seen as a character defect almost in a lot of cultures. And that makes it so much worse. Whereas if you were to have the same standard of living in a country, maybe in Africa or parts of Asia or Latin America, where the general standard of living was lower, then you wouldn't feel as bad because you'd be comparing yourself very differently. And your poverty wouldn't be stigmatized so much. But you're in a culture where you're exposed to thousands of marketing messages about what the good life is every day. It's going to make you feel desperately unhappy. But there are techniques for fighting back against it. I've talked a lot about the concept of voluntary simplicity, another brilliant book by Duane Elgin, which is, if you like, a philosophy and a series of practices for being happy and fulfilled, even if you have very little money. But to answer this question, but being grateful works with any level of income and in any situation. Gratitude done properly every day as a ritual will boost your well-being. And in my professional work, for example, I've worked in organizations where the board of directors, who are all on six figures, are basically miserable, toxic, stressed, unwell. Yet people, and I'm thinking of a hotel I work with, where the maids who are on minimum wage were far happier, far more fulfilled, because their attitude was that they were there to almost love the guests and treat the guests as guests in their own homes. Whereas the people on the board were all worrying about their, you know, their dividends and who was going to be promoted. And they created a very damaging story for themselves, whereas the people on the minimum level had created a very empowering story. Now, that might be unusual, but the point is psychologically, the link between happiness and income is not what you might think. The long question, long answer.
Sherry, do you want to, Sherry?
Hi, yeah, for those who don't know, I'm Sherry Clark. I live in Hastings and I'm the chair of Transition Town Hastings. Paul, this is so interesting. I have a background in positive psychology as well. And I'm leading on something right now in Hastings called the Emerging Futures Program, which is part of the National Lottery Emerging Futures Project. And I just wanted to share with you guys, obviously I'm in a very different part of the world. And one of the things that we're doing as part of the Emerging Futures Program is I'm running a series of 10 sessions. They're called the Common Room. And what I'm introducing is the basics of positive psychology and talking about just raising awareness of what negative emotions do physiologically and also to creativity and innovation. And we've run a couple just sort of test sessions. And what's been really interesting is to start to look at that story, you know, both at an individual level and also at a community level. So, you know, being in a town that has by definition had this story about it's a failure place, and starting to say, okay, what can we celebrate here? What is it that we want to speak about? And what are those, we're talking about creating approach goals as well, that rather than saying, you know, let's stop doing this, what are the things that we want to move more towards? So we're orienting ourselves towards creating a much more positive vision and also a much more positive conversation about Hastings that then puts into play the notion that the more we can create these positive environments, the more people are going to be drawn into it. But it's very interesting right now because, you know, a lot of the people have lived here for a long time, have this story that this is a really shitty place to live and it's never going to get any better. So this is, it's just a very, very, very helpful conversation. I really appreciate being part of it today. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Sherry. No, and you're absolutely, everything you say is so true. And you just said, so many of us frame our lives in terms of what we don't want or what we're moving away from. Aversion, as the Buddhists would say, but what we need to do is far more focus. And this is one of the elements of the story work I do, is focusing on how we want to be, how we want to live, but not in terms of just our outside world, though that's very important, but in terms of our inner life. You know, one of the things I talk about in my book on Groundhog Day is, write, we all know what a bucket list is, but why not write an inner bucket list? And by that I mean, write about how you want to feel, how you want to think, how you want to experience your life. Because the fact is, in Hastings, there'll be people who are far happier on minimum wage than there are billionaires in Park Avenue in Manhattan. And it is so much about our inner story. We have to address social conditions 100%. It needs inner and outer work. But all the emphasis seems to be on outer work, or so much of it in life. And very few of us are trained to work on our inner life.
I think one of the other things, just very quickly, is to say, you know, in relation to the question that was asked, one of the biggest challenges here, and I'm I had an argument with someone very recently about this, was this notion of the other, and that, you know, how are we going to change these other people in poor parts of Hastings and Orr and Hollington and all these places? And I said, you know, these are the people who have the lowest carbon footprints in this town. Mm-hmm. Why are you trying to change people that you have no right to talk to about this stuff? They should be telling you what to do differently. And I think there's a real tension around that as well, because we haven't got enough of an understanding that those people who are living actually, you know, for lots of different reasons, they're living low carbon lives and lots of challenging reasons, but they are actually doing something right in the world.
I couldn't agree more.
That as well.
That's a brilliant point. Just quickly, I talked earlier about my revelation in 1999 when I read The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. What I didn't say was that I was traumatized by this book, because up to then I thought I'd been getting everything right. I thought this is what you're supposed to do when you run a very successful business. Yet I suddenly felt guilty, I felt immoral, I felt sordid. But I had been traveling around the world, first class, living it up, and you know, living those standards, because that's what I've been taught. And I really didn't like myself for a long period of time. And you're right, to redefine morality in terms of what we consume is a very powerful story that we should all be thinking about and expressing ourselves and to other people. So excellent. Thank you, Sherry. Very good points.
Thank you. Now, although we do say we can go on till 3:30, oh, look, Barbara, we won't feel compelled that we must, because this is brilliant, but yeah, Chrome can get a bit tiring. So, Barbara, you have a point. Anyone else, please raise your hand.
It's, I think, it's trying to make it inclusive rather than exclusive. So how would you go about that, and how do you get all sorts of people's ideas and perspectives on things so that you actually come up with solutions that actually work for everybody rather than just a minority?
Yeah. Well, it's a brilliant question. You know, we've been talking about this on the Your Better Nature, on other work I'm doing. It's the same old story, isn't it, about the environmental movement. It's a very narrow group of people. And until we can be more diverse, until we can speak to every demographic, it's very difficult to build the sort of movement that we need to make the major change. But the thing is, and this is, again, coming back to the idea of stories, if we define our identity through our colour, through our gender, through our income, through our demographic, through our education, we are doomed to failure. If we define our identity through our shared, universal, common experience of what it means to be a human being on a planet that is facing destruction, where our grandchildren, great-grandchildren will not survive, where we're destroying species at an unprecedented rate. If we really define, and this is, I think, the really big work to do about a story, is to let go of those superficial differences and come into what unites us during this purpose. And I feel very strongly about that.
Liz, do you want to go?
Hi. Yeah, I just want to make a plug, actually. You go into primary schools, and obviously this is absolutely, totally needed, but a lot of kids are going hungry at the moment, and there have been cases of malnutrition in this country, absolutely shockingly. UK Harvest takes food from supermarkets and redistributes it in the form of breakfast clubs and goes to food banks. Food banks also, I've heard, have been closing because they haven't got volunteers. So it's the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, isn't it? The first bit is you have food. So could I just please plug that for people who want to volunteer, or who can, if you're going into schools, if they know about UK Harvest, because it's relatively new.
How does it compare to community fridges, Liz?
I don't know. I've only worked with UK Harvest. They started off in Chichester. They're in Donington, but they go all over now to Horsham as well, to Brighton, they go up to London. So they really are expanding. They had a huge donation from the cruise liners. And I work with them on Thursday because the cruise liners are not going anywhere. And there were crates and crates and crates of beautiful fruit and veg going out to different places. They are also looking for volunteers because they're down on their volunteers. Food banks are down on volunteers. So that's, yeah.
Okay. So Victoria, are you there? Can you turn on? Because Victoria, who's one of our lovely volunteers, is trying to set up a community fridge in Horsham. So I don't know whether you have anything to add or about UK Harvest and I don't know.
UK Harvest. And I know that the person who started the Littlehampton fridge and is doing the Horsham fridge knows about it as well. But we, the community fridges, take waste from supermarkets. We can take stuff from community gardens, but I think they're kind of fulfilling different roles, aren't they? Because
they do take it from supermarkets. UK Harvest take from supermarkets.
Oh, okay. The only ones I know about are field gleaning. The UK Harvest. Sorry? The UK Harvest that I looked at was field gleaning.
No.
Oh, okay. No. Maybe it's the same organization then, because there's a couple organizations. I'm not as into it as the founder is. But there's a few places that we get food from. So maybe UK Harvest is one of the organizations.
Okay. They do a trawl every day from the Greggs, Marks and Spencers, all the big supermarkets and the farms.
I know that there's one called Fair Divide, I think it is.
Okay.
I can't remember all the names of them all. I'm just in the process of moving. So my head is a little bit everywhere. I can send that to Sarah and make sure she does actually know about it. But yeah, the Horsham Community Fridge just got a space at St. Mary's Church. So we'll be opening up shortly, hopefully.
Fantastic.
Getting the volunteers organized, which is then obviously another way for people to access food, isn't it?
But yeah, we can certainly, I mean, we're in liaison. So through our Horsham Future Forum, which is a meeting that takes place every Wednesday, the Horsham Community Fridge came along and gave a talk and explained to us the difference between the food bank and the community fridge. So yeah, we can certainly, we'll look into UK Harvest as well and, you know, explore synergies. So I think unless anyone has any, I had an idea, Paul, how about, I don't know really whether our stories have to remain private or whether Kia's going to write a really brilliant blog for us. And then we'll share it out with the recording. Is our story private, Paul, or as a way of furthering, you know, the inspiration that you've given us today, could any of us that want to go away and think about what we've learned, read Keir's blog, listen to the podcast, and maybe revisit this our story in, I don't know, I'm going to say a month's time, I don't know. To come back, anyone that wants to come back and see where this experience, this knowledge has, how it's changed us. Is there any benefit in that or is that a bit?
I think it'd be great. I mean, I'm very happy to continue the conversation, definitely. And also coming back to the question Jerry asked earlier about how you actually make the change more stable and more permanent. One of the best ways of doing it is to write out your story. And once you're happy with it, once you feel secure in it and yourself, to start telling other people. And then you've got peer pressure. Then, you know, it's like if you want to give up smoking, tell everybody you've given up smoking or alcohol, whatever it is. And then it doesn't mean you'll 100% do it, but it means more likely. And I think it's, if you have a story that when you say it really resonates within you and you feel embodied with it and it's meaningful. And then when you say it, you feel like you're coming alive. That's the best way of knowing if you've got the right story. Speak it into a microphone, record it, speak it to somebody close to you and notice how you feel. Notice your level of energy, of vibrancy. And when it really picks up, you know you've got the right story. And I'm very happy to continue.
Okay. So what sort of time frame do you think we might give?
I don't mind, really. Whatever is right for you. Maybe a couple of months, 2 or 3 months, or next month. I really don't mind. I mean, if you're really keen to go with this, the sooner the better, really. Just stick with it.
Okay, well, what I'd say is the people that are here today, some of you, I suppose most of you, have probably booked through Eventbrite. When you book through Eventbrite, you have the option to actually select to go on our mailing list. If you're not sure whether you, because we're trying to behave much better with my use of data, I've got a volunteer who's helping me with our data strategy. But yeah, if you're not sure whether you actually signed up to our mailing list via Eventbrite, either email me or go to sussexgreenliving.co.uk, use the contact form or the follow button, and then you'll be added to our list. And then you'll be on our mailing list. And then what we'll do is liaise with